From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As politicians debate whether or not Americans deserve $15 an hour of minimum wage or decent unemployment benefits, a forgiveness of onerous college loan debt, or nationalized health care, a new book singles out the so-called professional managerial class, or PMC. Its author, Catherine Liu, calls the PMC, quote, the credentialed elite class that serves capitalism while insisting on its own progressive heroism. In other words, those who are members of the PMC offer up their liberal views as compensation for serving capitalist structures that buttress their own power. Catherine Liu is a professor of film and media studies at UC Irvine. She's the author of Copying Machines, Taking Notes for the Automaton. And her latest book is called Virtue Hoarders, The Case Against the Professional Managerial Class. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
So, of course, the first question is, what is the professional managerial class? How does one know if one is in it?
Well, I'm in it. You're in it, probably. It's called people employed in the creative industries who can work now from home are probably in it. John and Barbara Ehrenreich defined the class as a class of people who were credentialed, who needed to have professional imprimaturs or college educations, and they were increasingly taking over the activist left in post-68 America. I like to define the class as being people who do not work with their bodies. You don't lift things. You don't have to pound things in the ground. You don't have to carry things. You're not working on an assembly line. If you also need to go to college to get your job, or instead of getting on-the-job training like an apprenticeship or in a restaurant, then you're in the PMC. Now, the PMC is extremely stratified today. I would say the upper reaches of the PMC are those who are people in the White House now and in corporate America and in finance, insurance, and real estate who are doing things that people don't understand. And then the lower reaches of the PMC go right into the public teachers and public teachers unions have been very active, and they've been much more, I think, supportive of universal programs like Medicare for All. Nurses are at the lower end of the PMC. You do need a credential. The National Nurses Union is also supportive of Medicare for All. But you'll find that in the upper reaches of the PMC, from journalists like Ezra Klein to politicians like liberal politicians like Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, or people who we think of as liberal, they have a much more hesitant role in hesitant support of universal programs like Medicare for All. Now, Bernie Sanders stood out as an exception in the last election, but I would say that people who are into technocratic solutionism are policymakers in the PMC. So I hope that's clear. But if you're working with your body and you are actually damaged and suffer on the job injury because of physical labor, you are not in the PMC.
So it's more sort of intellectual workers, if you will.
White collar workers, yeah. I mean, not all of the PMC is intellectual. I would say where I am in the university, people are less and less intellectual. They're more and more managerial.
So why is it that there is a disconnect between the values of especially the upper echelons of the PMC and the political struggles that they will actually back in real ways?
I find, despite their veneer of liberalism, they are profoundly conservative and they want to maintain the status quo.
And you're talking in general terms, obviously, here.
Yeah. But, the status quo served them very well, and for my class, I can work online. I'm not exposed to the damages of the pandemic so much. And so they don't want big changes. They want small structural changes. No, small like policy tweaks. And they want to keep their level of superiority with regard to the working class. The other thing is that they are basically friendly to capitalism. They like centrism. Elizabeth Warren supporters, like many of my colleagues, were perfect examples of this class. They don't really want change. They don't want economic distribution because economic redistribution would hurt them. They probably have to pay more taxes. And they like tweaking things. They're moderates. And they like cultural change rather than real economic transformation of the capitalist system that is not serving the majority of Americans and, in fact, damaging the life worlds of the majority of Americans.
Now, there is a lot of resentment against this class of people, although they're not always identified in this way. You say in your book, Virtue Hoarders, no one has been as effective at mobilizing popular resentment of the PMC as Donald Trump. Can you explain?
I think Donald Trump represents like all of the opposite of PMC values. He's like the id that's rebelling against the PMC superego that tells us how to do things, why to do things. And Trump just flouted all of that. You know, he just enjoyed his money. He was a, you know, out and out capitalist. He was angry. He didn't listen to the experts. And I feel like that he appealed to a lot of Americans who are angry at the liberal professions, at these talking heads, at experts who told them how to live their lives and then made their lives worse. And Trump appealed to this kind of populist resentment that's been growing. I should also say that it's global. It's a global phenomenon. Autocrats from Erdogan to the president of Hungary to what's happening in Poland to Bolsonaro in Brazil. These are demagogic figures that appeal to the resentment of a class that's presided over a kind of centrist, liberal, moderate regimes that have not served the people.
And of course, even the Trumpers themselves don't necessarily act out or live up to their stated ideals. That should be mentioned.
Yeah. No, I don't know what their ideals are. They don't have ideals. They don't. No, they actually don't have ideals. They are like pure expressions of rage, resentment, racism, and anger at a system that sometimes works for them. I mean, I would have to say that the working classes actually did not vote for Trump in large numbers. They maintained their numbers from the Democrats. Trumpers actually are just angry, sort of maybe downwardly mobile middle-class people or rich people who don't want to pay taxes. I don't want to defend them necessarily. I just am saying that there is an emotional reaction to the professional managerial classes, sort of liberal authoritarianism, if you like, about every aspect of life and redistributive policies. And I feel like they, the right wing, knows how to speak to this anger. And the left, with the exception on the, you know, sort of elected official level, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, likes to lecture us. You know, the liberals and the Democrats.
A big part of the break between the, say, centrist Democrats and the more left Democrats, of which, well, Bernie Sanders is technically an independent, but there are some new members of the House that you might consider much more progressive. They're newer, certainly. A big part of that focuses on incremental change versus radical change, right? You'll have folks who will say, we need Medicare for all now. We need, you know, even $15 an hour. If minimum wage is not enough. We should have had that 10 years ago. And then you've got those who say, first we'll have Obamacare, and then maybe someday we could get to Medicare for all. Is that the big problem?
That's a huge problem, huge problem. I mean, $15 minimum wage an hour is already a moderate adjustment. You know that if we had the 1968 minimum wage adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage today would be $22 an hour. And that's actually the living wage. $15 an hour just barely skims the surface. I don't know why this is controversial for people. I mean, they represent, maybe these moderates represent these purple regions and they're terrified of their own supporters. But this kind of incrementalism is going to kill the Democratic Party in 2022. That's my prediction. People are really suffering. Can you imagine living on $9 an hour? I think that's like slavery, modern day slavery. And We're in a five-alarm fire with regard to inequality in this country. The rawness of the suffering of the people cannot be ignored. And if the left doesn't understand that, then the right is going to take advantage of it.
Right. And just to stay on that for one more moment, Ed Merkley, who is spearheading an effort to end the Senate filibuster, said it will be a Democratic Party Armageddon in 2022 if we sit on our butts and say, oh, we're sorry, we're not as determined to get our agenda passed as Republicans were. Well, what is exactly the interest of the professional managerial class when it comes to just talking about class itself? Do you find that this group of people doesn't like to address the issue of class?
No, it doesn't want to talk about class. It wants to naturalize its own superiority because this class succeeded during the meritocracy, and it wants to just say, like, it's reasonable people. This is pure ideology in action. Marx really explained this very well, where you have the power structure naturalize inequality, naturalize inequity, ideology naturalizes the inequality of capitalism. And the PMC dominates ideological productions from television to prestige TV to filmmaking to the media. I mean, you are very much an exception to the mainstream media's nostra. They all go to the same schools, they all speak the same language, and they all think that incrementalism is like common sense. It's not. It's not at this point in this country. I mean, it's a crime that 3 out of 5 children in America have known hunger in a country this prosperous.
I just want to, you know, point out, and this is a pet peeve of mine, there's a new film out called Nomadland that everybody is raving about because it covers the retired Americans that are living out of their campers and moving from job to job because they can't afford to retire on their pensions, and primarily the kinds of the jobs they're taking are Amazon jobs. And while the book that the film was based on, Nomadland, really did point out the horrific economic system that forces these people into these conditions, the film barely grazes the surface of it. And I'm wondering if you think that's precisely why it's getting such rave reviews and is an Oscar contender.
I think that is probably why. It also stars Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, who are prestige actors in Hollywood who seem more progressive. And I think that one of the things that it does is it aestheticizes this nomadic lifestyle as if it were a choice. And I feel like
the two protagonists in the film both have options for middle class lives in their families' homes, and they choose not to take those paths. But everyone thinks it's this incredible radical film, and I don't see that.
No, I mean, the thing about the collapse of the pension system of retirement is disastrous. I think there's one character in the film who has cancer and is just she's just going to live out the rest of her. And she's a real character. I mean, there's some non-actors.
Linda May, I believe, is her name.
Yeah. And they're very, very powerful testimonies to the ways in which American society has collapsed. I mean, for me, that film is about, you know, the collapse of American society and collapse.
Without actually speaking to very clearly to the reasons why.
Right. Absolutely. And the West looks so beautiful. You know, it looks like it's just like a beautiful landscape that you can travel, and you can travel from harvesting beets in Nebraska to working in your Amazon warehouse. And it's kind of like, you know, you're on vacation or something. You're not on vacation. You're home. You're without a home. And I do feel like people, Frances McDormand Fern plays a character who's so destroyed by grief of the loss of her husband, but grief also of the closing down of a mine in which an entire blue-collar community is destroyed. And I think that that mourning becomes personalized and individualized as her own inability to get over the loss of her husband. And that's another thing that the PMC is really good at, is individualizing our experiences of economic trauma and making them making the individual the field where solutions and redemptions can be found.
Rather than systemic critiques, right?
Exactly.
So, Catherine, where does the issue of race fit into how the professional managerial class, tries to stultify real progress.
Well, look what happened with the real organic anger of Black Lives Matters last summer when George Floyd was killed, I would say, for passing $20 counterfeit bill. And it's his economic marginalization and his poverty as a Black man that made him so vulnerable to police violence. But there was like outrage about that. You know what it's translated into? Corporate and academic anti-bias training in human resources. All of that energy has been sucked away by PMC anti-bias trainers. And it's been a new form of discipline at work that everyone who works at a large organization right now has to go through. All of that energy, the demand for social justice and economic justice that exploded across America last summer, has been turned into work discipline. And that to me is really, really upsetting, but it also, is the realization, it also confirms what John and Barbara Ehrenreich wrote in 1977. The PMC completely dominates like the left liberal institutions in the United States right now. And so all of that energy gets sucked into the Democratic Party, gets sucked into private foundations. And then what we have is a way of punishing people at work for not standing in line to this very managed top-down notion of anti-racism. Racism is real. Racism is one of the realities of American life that we should all be struggling against. But the PMC once again wants to monopolize anti-racism for its own benefit.
Right. And Black Lives Matter, at least, certain aspects of the leadership has very systemic critique of the American economy as it intersects with race. That is often lost. I mean, that's what's meant by defund the police, which is, considered far too radical by those same members of the PMC that will put a Black Lives Matter sticker on their wall.
Yeah, well, I live in a wealthy neighborhood in Southern California, and everyone can put, Black Lives Matter posters on their yard, in their yards. But Orange County zoning makes this whole, they would be horrified if we had like lower income housing very close to us, or even like a homeless encampment, because there's a lot of open space where we live that could be opened up next to us. I mean, someone suggested this in our neighborhood and people were like, oh no, and this was a couple of years ago, but it was like, you know what? We have all of the resources, we have all of the space, but we're not going to give that up. We're going to actually just increase our home values by putting that Black Lives Matter sign on the yard. I'm sorry, I'm so angry about this.
I love it. That's why you wrote a book.
If you're listening to this, I think you're very nice people, but I really don't think that's enough. Okay. Yeah. Why didn't you vote for Bernie?
So you mentioned private foundations. Let's talk about that. There is this giant world of philanthropy that is, in a way, a natural outcome of the fact that inequality is ridiculous because so much money has flowed to the top that the ultra wealthy, kind of feel like they can throw a few crumbs our way through private foundations. How do the virtue hoarders, manage progressive change through private foundations in a way that makes you angry?
That's a very, very good question. And you set it up very well in already saying that it's because of the Reagan era tax breaks on the wealthiest Americans and corporations that there are such bloated and grotesque the large endowments for private foundations. So if we look at Rockefeller, Carnegie, Ford, and Mellon, these are four of the biggest foundations. All of these people were in extractive industries. They shot their workers who struck in the early part of the 20th century. They were the most vicious bosses in the world, but they have completely whitewashed their reputations. And you have liberals in my profession who just bow down before these corporations. It is well known that Carnegie Foundation funding is Carnegie initiatives for peace, was an ancillary part of the American Cold War in terms of global affairs. And now we have all of these private foundations trying to define what progressive people can do, what progressive institutions like universities can do. And they are just ancillary parts of this grotesque inequality that we have today. The kinds of mind control that they exert over the liberal professions, like, you know, nonprofits and universities, is unbelievable. But no one will say anything because everyone wants a grant from Mellon. Everyone wants a grant from Rockefeller. Everyone wants a grant from Ford. And it is, they've completely taken over nonprofits and nonprofit agendas. And the one thing nobody wants to hear is class. Class struggle, class difference, class contradiction, or the overriding power of class in terms of identifying identifying oppression. So you have like what you won't hear about is working class Asian Americans, working class African Americans, working class South Asians, working class Native Americans. No, we're all these special categories in this pluralistic world in these for these private foundations. And we can, and they want to empower people who are minorities, but notice who is the agent of empowerment. It's the private foundation. It's the PMC person. Everyone is just an object of their largesse.
I want to focus in on one of the things that you discuss in your book about the chapter is called The PMC Has Children. Again, reminder for those just tuning in, we're talking about the professional managerial class. And my guest, Catherine Liu, is the author of the book Virtue Hoarders. How does parenting and the politics around the PMC's politics around parenting in a way replicate these values that are so detrimental to progress?
I have to big shout out to Barbara Ehrenreich and Christopher Lash too on all this stuff. Ehrenreich wrote that, you know, fear of falling in the 1980s had to do with this PMC recognition that there was no social safety net anymore. Christopher Lash wrote in the 70s that the white collar workers had become such good gatekeepers of the professions that their own children were going to have trouble getting into the professions. So we've made higher education and credentialism into this luxury good. We're terrified that our children are not going to be able to benefit from this luxury good, because here's the thing about the PMC is that it actually doesn't have enough wealth to pass on, like inherited wealth for their children. And this was supposed to be a good thing because we were defeating feudalism and everyone had to recompete for their offices, if you like, in the, you know, civil service Chinese way of civil service exams. And so, you know, you may be very successful as a lawyer, but, you know, you're not going to give your office to your kid. He has to go to school and get, you know, a law degree to become a lawyer. And now that we have no social safety net, young people are facing incredible rates of unemployment and student loan debt. We have PMC parents who, the richer they are, the more anxious they are terrified that their kids are not going to be able to compete. So from day one of their child's life, they're trying to optimize their child for either creativity or competition. Like the more craven ones will just say optimize for competition, and the more liberal ones will say optimize for creativity. But in any case, child rearing has become this technique that the PMC parent has to master in order to allay his or her anxiety about the child, your children's future chances in the world. Never mind that we've lived through 40 years of defunding public education, defunding Head Start, defunding any kind of publicly funded childcare. Never mind that we have punished women on welfare who, in order to get their, you know, TAMP, their family, you know, supplements, have to prove that they can go to work. So they have to put their children to childcare. No, we don't think about those things. We think about optimization of our own children's educations, their private educations. The more this kind of fear and anxiety pervade, the more corruption and cheating there is at the top. I mean, this whole thing that exploded, Operation Varsity Blues, I don't know if you heard about this, which had to do with Rick Singer, a college counselor to the wealthy, finding these side doors for very wealthy people to allow their children entry into schools like UCLA, Georgetown, Yale, Stanford. That is a direct result of this attitude that your children have to be optimized, pushed. You have to use every single kind of advantage that you have to make them the succeed in an increasingly cruel and competitive world. So don't change that world. Don't change capitalism. Just make your children the winners.
Right. Well, I could talk to you all day, Catherine, but certainly I know our audience can pick up a copy of your book, Virtue Porters, to get the fullness of it. Thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for these wonderful questions.
My guest is Catherine Liu. She's a professor of film and media studies at the University of California, Irvine. We've been talking about her latest book, Virtue Hoarders, The Case Against the Professional Managerial Class. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.